is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, June 12th, 2020. Producing from his home in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home office in New York. And Taylor, I think this is the weekend the two sides will actually reach an agreement. What do you think?
Oh, Buster, don't get me excited. I know it should happen a long time ago, but I'm ready to watch some games, anything. I'll watch practice at this point. We're talking about practice.
Yeah, you're feeling better about it than I am, because my first question is going to be, if in fact they have an agreement, and I'm hearing that it might be around 70 games at full pay, my first question to the two sides is going to be, why did you guys wait 6 weeks to get to this point? Where were you 6 weeks ago with these compromises? Let's hope they find a way to do it for sure. And so that they can begin to move ahead and to rebuild everything that's burned down in the baseball house. Today, we'll be taking Todd Radom's weekly quiz as the Empire Strikes Back. And we'll talk with Tim Kuhn, who wrote a nuanced piece about the Sosa McGuire home run chase of 1998. Before we get to that, some news and notes. Alex Cora, the former manager of the Boston Red Sox and, of course, the former bench coach of the Houston Astros, who's currently serving a suspension from the 2017 sign-stealing scandal, told Marley Rivera of ESPN on Thursday that he deserved his punishment for his role in the Astros scheme, but he took umbrage with his suggestions that he and Carlos Beltran, the Astros' designated hitter in his final season of majors in 17, were the driving forces behind it. This is a quote from Alex Cora. There has been a narrative out there of what happened ever since mid-November until the commissioner announced the results of the Red Sox investigation. I have read many things that are true and many others that are not. Out of this whole process, if there's one thing that I completely reject and disagree with, is people within the Astros organization singling me out, particularly former general manager Jeff Luhnow, as if I were the sole mastermind. The commissioner's report sort of explained in its own way what happened, but the Astros players have spoken up and refuted any allegations that I was solely responsible. He added, if there is one thing I am absolutely sure of, it is that this was not a two-man show. We all did it, and let me be very clear that I am not denying my responsibility because we were all responsible. Baseball completed its five-round draft on Thursday, and now we wait to learn about the fate of Major League Baseball in 2020. There's still no formal resolution of baseball's labor stoppage, and in that context, our friend Carl Ravitch tweeted out after the draft, I love baseball, but I don't like it very much right now. Before we get to Todd Radom and to Tim Kuhn, a final reminder about ESPN's latest 30 for 30, Long Gone Summer. It airs Sunday, June 14th at 9 p.m. Eastern. And after the airing of Long Gone Summer, you can check out Jalen Jacoby's The After Show podcast with Long Gone Summer director A.J. Schnock. You can find that wherever you get your podcast. And a reminder that all 30 for 30 films are available on ESPN Plus immediately after airing. Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world. Or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how you doing this morning?
Hanging in there, Buster. How are you?
I'm doing okay. As I mentioned to Taylor off the top of the show, I feel like in the next few days we could get an agreement. And my first response is going to be, where the heck were the compromises 4 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago? And that even if they get an agreement at this point, it's almost going to feel anticlimactic. How about for you?
Yeah, I agree, Buster. And of course, everything gets framed in light of everything else going on in the world right now. It would be really nice to have something good and, to take our minds off of the world at large and the complexity of it. But the fact that this has been grinding on and just so painful to watch, it's hard. It is really hard to watch. And when it finally does come back, I just think there's going to be a stink attached to it that I hope goes away sooner rather than later.
Yeah, our friend Carl Ravitch tweeted out after the draft coverage last night something that last time I checked, it was liked by over 10,000 people. His quote was, I love baseball, but I don't like it very much right now. And I think that's the way a lot of fans are feeling in the moment. Today on ESPN.com, I posted a piece that I worked on over the last few weeks. I talked to five pitchers who allowed home runs to both Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa. I had a lot of fun, you know, catching up with some of these guys who I covered, Andy Bennis, Rick Reed. I got to know Willie Blair, you know, his days as a player. You know, among those, and this is total self-promotion of this piece, was there anything that jumped out at you in the piece, Todd, that you had fun with?
Well, it brought back some warm memories. Talk about not so warm things going on right now. These were warm memories. And yes, you know, a certain amount of it was, well, maybe a lot of it was chemically induced. But boy, watching those guys just go at it every single day, day after day. And for people, you know, your age and my age, Buster, and again, I'll say it like I always do, we're exact contemporaries. That 61 record of Maris was just, you know, just like this giant behemoth that you could never, nobody really ever came close to. And to watch these guys closing in on it in in August was just astounding. I'm thinking of being at Wrigley Field in the summer of 98, being really down low and watching McGuire take batting practice, Cardinals, Cubs, beautiful day at Wrigley, and, you know, living in the moment and knowing that I was seeing something incredibly special. Last thing, too, just personal memory, watching Home Run Derby in 99. How much fun was that at Fenway? And McGuire is just, you know, putting him out there, you know, onto the cask and flagging beyond the left field wall. Just unbelievable.
Yeah, we're going to have a conversation with Tim Kuhn coming up, who wrote a great nuanced piece about the McGuire and Sosa home run chase. And we're going to, I'm sure we're going to talk about how that year in 98, McGuire just seemed put upon. Like it was, he looked like he was not having any fun, but I got the feeling by 99 with that home run derby that he was having more fun with it, Todd. Cause I remember that being a really cool event in 99.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, clearly the pressure, incumbent upon him, and I guess to a lesser extent, Sosa, in retrospect, to get past that 62, and how high can you go? 70 is just unfathomable. Of course, it doesn't seem real in retrospect. You pile Barry Bonds on top of that, but what we were watching, it all seemed so innocent then, didn't it, Buster?
Well, no, not really. But you'll hear Tim and I will address that, being reporters in the game at that time and what we saw and what we missed. All right. As we do our examination of ballparks in the big leagues this week, we're talking about the ballparks in St. Louis and the current Busch Stadium. Todd, as I got ready for this, your phrase that you love to talk about, a sense of place. There's no doubt about it. The current Busch Stadium has a sense of place.
Yeah, Buster. And clearly it is elevated by the fact that it's in St. Louis, which is, of course, one of America's greatest baseball cities. You know, I mean, that elevates everything. Here's a couple of things that came to mind when I was prepping some notes for today's discussion. You know, in a certain sense, it's kind of a Camden Yards wannabe. There's a lot of brick. There's a lot of steel. It doesn't have a ton of really unique attributes. But then you get to the part that where it does have some unique attributes, and that is the entrance, which emulates the Eads Bridge in St. Louis, those arches, right? I love I love walking around that ballpark, not the side by the highway so much, which you know, takes some points off if you want to look at it that way, but they had to squeeze it in where they had to squeeze it in. But the view from left field, the fact that you could be at street level and see this beautiful expanse of stadium is tremendous. I love the fact that, you know, it looks like a ballpark for the Cardinals. The colors are just right. All of those red seats. I think it's interesting, Buster, that you have Ballpark Village, that mixed-use development out there beyond left field. Up until a few years ago, there was really nothing there. It has filled in considerably. So it really feels like the ballpark sort of opens its arms a little bit more to downtown. And I think it's a great place to see a game. St. Louis is a great baseball city. Again, you got to say it. Personally, I have a great deal of affection for the Cardinals because they really appreciate their visual history. You walk around that ballpark and the relief carvings of various Cardinals logos and uniform designs from throughout the ages are there. And I really appreciate that. And I love the Cardinals Hall of Fame and Museum. They've been good colleagues, too. And they really, again, they take their history so seriously.
I've told you in the past that I always look at the ballparks from a very selfish perspective, the utility of it. And they have one of the most inaccessible press boxes because it's so high. It's basically on top of the building. They gave the premium seats behind home plates to fans. I can't say that as a business person, I necessarily blame them. I can't tell you that it's necessarily a great place to go and cover a game from the press box, but I've always loved, you know, looking out beyond center field and there's the arch. And I agree with you about sort of the visual aspect of the ballpark. And there's no doubt, I think you'll agree with me in this regard, Todd. Look, we know that, you know, fans love to wear their team colors. There's no place that you'll go where you'll see more team colors worn by fans than in St. Louis.
Yeah, it is a sea of red and it's a really festive atmosphere and just a wonderful thing to see. And Buster, the last time I was there, I didn't get there last season, but I spoke at a small conference 2 years ago in the off season. And it took place in one of the on the club level over there, and the World Series trophies are in this room and some examples of game worn uniforms. And I got to kind of hang around an empty ballpark and see places where you never normally see. And it was really just so cool. Stayed downtown right across from the stadium. Again, there it is, the unique sense of place. And it's, you know, such a historic franchise. So many great things to hit on there. But the fans do love their team and the city loves the Cardinals. And it's a great place to see a ball game as far as I'm concerned.
Old Busch Stadium for me, colossally boring. Nothing stood out about it. One of the cookie cutters, but you have a special memory there.
I do, Buster. I'm recalling the night of game four, the 2004 World Series. You know, never thought I'd live to see it happen as a Red Sox fan, but it took place there. So it has some very good stuff attached to it.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And I will just interject for a second. I'm going to disagree with you to some extent.
Wow.
It was a round multi-purpose stadium, but it had some unique stuff going on. It had a modernist architectural feel. There was the roof, the crown of arches with the small gateway arches around the perimeter, this sort of very thin-shelled concrete ring. And you kind of had sort of a translucent look to it as opposed to these fortresses in, we're just going to name them again, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, and Philly, the concrete donuts. This was a little more light and lithe and had a little bit more humanity attached to it, I think. Maybe it's all the good memories. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the way you feel. And I have all the bad memories, you know, go crazy, folks, when Ozzy beat my Dodgers back in the playoffs. Yeah, it's, that might color my perspective as well. All right, let's get to this week's quiz, or as we've been calling it, The Empire Strikes Back.
Ooh, here we go. All right. I really love these ongoing conversations about which one of these events occurred most recently. So, which did? Is it A, the Minnesota Twins last appeared in the American League Championship Series? B, the Montreal Expos recorded their last winning season? C, the Seattle Mariners last appeared in the postseason? Or D, the MLB All-Star Game took place in Denver? Which occurred most recently? The Twins in the ALCS, the Expos with their last winning season, the Mariners last appearing in the postseason, or the MLB All-Star Game in Denver?
Man, Taylor, you have the advantage. You have honors, sir. You tee off first.
I'm going back and forth between the Mariners and the All-Star Game in Denver. I will lean Mariners C on this one.
Man, oh, man. All-Star Game in Denver.
Both of you are wrong.
Come on.
I'll take a draw.
In 2003, the Montreal Expos recorded their last winning season.
Wow.
The All-Star Game in Denver took place what year? 1998 seems to be a theme here. The Seattle Mariners last appeared in the postseason in 2001 when they won a slew of games and ran into the Yankees. So,
man, not only, I mean, Taylor was closer than I was, and the door was wide open for me, and I couldn't take advantage of it. So the Empire will have to strike back next week, Todd.
Well, hopefully we have some better news as it relates to baseball, Buster.
I think we will. All right, Todd, thanks for doing this.
Thanks, guys.
Tim Kuhn is a senior writer for ESPN and author of a piece posted Thursday on ESPN.com about the summer of 98, the long gone summer, to steal the name of the 30 for 30 piece about Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa that will air at 9 p.m. on Sunday. And Tim, in reading your piece, I was thinking back to, you know, 1998. I was a beat writer covering the Yankees at that time, but the Times did send me out for one weekend to work on a McGwire story. And I'm so glad that you remembered and captured the weariness that I remembered in McGwire in that summer of celebration.
Exactly. It was torture for him. I mean, it either was torture for him or he wanted us to think it was torture for him, because it was such a contrast in what people saw in that and what they wanted to believe and did believe, and the way that it affected him, because he did not exude joy. Let's put it that way.
What are some examples of that you saw?
Well, he just never really embraced it. I mean, I think that we know that it's hard, right? But to constantly talk about how hard it was, and you just don't dial up a home run. I mean, all these things that we knew, I just felt like there was something missing in the way that he approached it and the way that he sort of refused to embrace it, because you've got to read the room a little bit, right? I mean, you got to see that people really, really love this chase. They were hyped up for it. The time was right for it for a number of reasons, as we know. But it just felt like he didn't want to give an inch on any of it. And I don't know whether he felt he would be judged harshly if he didn't get it, and that was sort of him hedging his bets. But he would stand in the clubhouse after a game, and he might have gone, 0-for-3 or whatever, and he would just list the accomplishments of his teammates and say, why don't you go talk to this guy? Why don't you go talk to this guy? And it became kind of like it became almost performative at a certain point, where you just wanted to say, this is what it is. Deal with it. Nobody's here to find anything out about you, which eventually we probably all should have been more inclined to do that. But I don't know. It felt too hard. It felt like he was trying to make it too, he wanted us to know how hard it was so often that it got a little tiresome at times.
It's interesting, because in 95, I was covering the Orioles for the Baltimore Sun, and that was the year when Cal Ripken broke Lou Gehrig's record. And Cal, I think, like McGwire, was very much of a process person. I mean, he can't play in every game for 15 straight years without being a process guy and be the son of Cal Ripken Sr. unless you're a process guy. But I will say Cal really learned how to embrace parts of it. In other words, when the Orioles went on the road, he would always have a press conference with writers from that city, and he would talk about it, about the streak and what it meant. And then, of course, he signed so many autographs that year. He really stepped out, whether it was at the All-Star game or at 1 a.m. at Camden Yards. He signed so many autographs. And it doesn't feel like, other than, that night when McGwire broke the record, hit number 62, and gave the big hug to Sammy, that he really necessarily did that. As a writer covering that, how did you handle that?
Well, I think, Buster, I've often thought, what would the perception of that summer have been had Sosa not showed up? If there had not been someone like Sammy Sosa chasing McGwire, and someone with the proximity to St. Louis that the Cubs had, with the number of times they played each other, the natural rivalry between the two teams, I just felt at the time that Sosa almost saved McGwire's reputation, because had it gone on, Sammy showed up sort of like in June when he hit 20 homers, and that changed everything, because he brought a little bit of levity to McGwire, almost forced it out of him. And I felt that, had that not happened, I think that everyone would have really tired of McGwire. I think that it would have changed the way that we perceived it, because he was this big, piece of Americana that everyone wanted to rally around. But, had it gone 6 months of just that dirge of everyday complaint, I think his memories would be different. I'm not sure we would be celebrating that summer quite as much as our 30 for 30 does.
So for a piece for that's posted on Friday morning on ESPN.com, there were 17 pitchers who allowed home runs to both Sosa and McGuire that summer. I talked with five of them, and all of them talked about the batting practice and how there was excitement over coming out and watching those guys get in the cage. The only one, Jason Beret, told me a story about how when he was playing in St. Louis, there was no way he was going to go as the opposing starting pitcher. He typically would be in the first hitters group. McGuire would be in the last hitters group for the Cardinals. And he's like, I'm not going to watch that. Like that, I'm going to have that as my last mental image before I go into a start. But besides that, right. Rick Reed and Andy Bennis, Willie Blair are talking about going out early and sitting in the dugout to watch those guys put on a show. What do you remember about the scene?
Well, the scene grew. I mean, the scene started out, you know, everybody had sort of conditioned themselves to McGuire going after this record. And the batting practice was a highlight. I mean, everybody would show up and just the oohs and ahs. And I think people were allowed, most of the time, people were allowed in a little earlier than they are now, if I remember right. But, it was both teams lined up to watch. Fans just oohing and aahing. I mean, there were cheers louder than during the game, during batting practice. I can remember we had an auction at my kid's school. Talk about how times have changed, Buster. And I got the Giants to auction off to allow two people to watch batting practice before a game. And of course, they chose a Cardinals game. And I can just remember these guys who were, you know, successful guys who had, you know, done a lot in their lives, just standing there with their jaws wide open, you know, right outside the cage watching this. And it was like seeing it through their eyes kind of gave me a different look at it, because it was so different. And the sound was different. The reaction was different. The buzz was different. It was very unique and it was very cool. I mean, it was a very fun time for baseball.
Yeah, Jim Parquet told me that when you'd watch batting practice, it was like you wanted to yell at, hey, you got a loudspeaker in your bat or something with those two guys because of the show that they put on that year. Now, in your piece, it was very interesting. You finished with an image that you saw in the 30 for 30 about McGuire and Sosa that really stuck with you, and you did a great job of highlighting its importance.
Yeah, it just was like a beacon to me, because they show McGuire hitting a monstrous home run against the Giants, and just for a flash, the camera pans to Barry Bonds standing in the outfield. His arms are kind of crossed, and he's got this look on his face, and it's the mustachioed era of Barry Bonds, where he's probably about 190 pounds. He was the best player in the game, probably not arguably, for about a decade. And he was a different player than what we remember. And there was just a look on his face like, okay, so this is how it is. And it could not have been accidental to just have that flash to Barry, you know, and it just struck me like, okay, what's going through his mind. And what's going through his mind is, everybody better buckle up, because we're playing a different game now.
Right. And, of course, the theory has long been that after that, that's when Barry may have gotten, you know, in more. If he had been doing something, he might have gotten more into it after that. And it fueled what he would do over the next 6, 7, 8 years. It was interesting to read your perspective as a reporter, and you made reference to it, about what we should have done as reporters. And I have racked my brain about this. There's always a perception, I think, among some fans that the writers were just along for the ride and you didn't want to interrupt a cool story, even though we saw what was going on. And I've always thought, like, man, if I could have broken a story in 97, 98 about an individual player using PEDs, are you kidding? That's a story I absolutely would have loved. In fact, when I was at the Baltimore Sun, the sports editor there, Jack Gibbons, and I, And then when I went to the New York Times, Neil Amder and I, you know, we'd have conversations. How do we get at this story? And I, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, when I got to, you know, 2003, 2004, what I felt like, Tim, was that, you know what? We kept on focusing on getting one player to acknowledge it or talk about one player doing it, you know, get an ex-girlfriend, an ex-wife, an ex-trainer, look for some documentation somewhere, you know, a guy who worked out with him at a gym, a receipt or something like that. And in 2002, 2003, I started to think, no, you know what? We should have just been quoting players about what they were seeing, generally speaking, to at the very least, even if you couldn't write about it involving one player or one player's use or an individual player, at least get the observations of guys like Tony Gwynn, like Frank Thomas, about what they were seeing in the sport. Bob Nightingale wrote a story like that back in 1994 for the LA Times. That's what I feel like my mistake was when I look back on it. How about you?
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. And I think that what people don't get a lot of times in this, the average fan or whatever, is that number one, as you said, we would have loved to have broken that story. If you could have broken Mark McGwire's PED use in 98, you could have made a career out of it. I mean, you would have just been, you would have been a contrarian, right? Because everybody, nobody wanted to read that. But the other part that is missed is that you can't just print rumors. You can't just say, you can't just throw that out there and say, Mark, man, he sure looks like he's doing steroids, because that's unfair also, because you have to have, you have to have the backing of it. And I think that the only way you got that is if you just designated a team and put it, put people on it that just doggedly pursued it, because you weren't really going to get that day in and day out in a clubhouse. That just wasn't going to be the way you get it. But what you're saying is really smart, because you could have laid a foundation for what we eventually learned. You could have led people in a certain direction based on what those people that were sounding very quiet alarms, I would say, like Tony Gwynn, you could have really, you're right, that could have made it less of a shock when the truth actually came out, and it could have been sort of the stones along the trail that led people to where they needed to go.
Yeah, in spring of 2002, I did a piece at the for the New York Times, which I felt really good about. I quoted general managers on the record: Randy Smith, who was with the Tigers; Kevin Towers, late great Kevin Towers, who was with the Padres at the time; and others talking about how they use steroid speculation to shape contract offers to players, because they, you know, were saying, "Look, we believe that this is going on, and so when you see a guy put on 30 pounds, maybe you're not going to believe in that quite as much if that player's numbers right. suddenly spike." And I remember feeling good about that story for about 30 seconds and then going, I could have written that freaking story back in 1995. Like, and I think, yeah. You know, what you just said, I think was borne out by Lance Armstrong and what happened with him. Nobody got more scrutiny than he did, but it was a question of actually proving it. I was in a writer's seminar, coincidentally, I want to say like in 2000, and one of the people in that seminar had been in professional cycling. And, you know, you have those, the breaks in the sessions, and we're having a, you know, a beer. And I said to him, I said, hey, Lance Armstrong, is he cheating? And he looked at me and go, yeah, of course, everyone knows that. Like, of course, yep. Everyone in cycling is cheating. And I think you would agree with me, that's the way we felt about it covering baseball.
Oh, no question. And I think that, you know, the interesting thing, because we did just have this Lance Armstrong documentary, is that Lance complained about having to answer that question over and over and over. It was almost the opposite with McGwire. Nobody asked him. You know, he wasn't really asked about that in a press conference setting. And there was a certain maybe intimidation factor or what, but he never had to. And I often wonder if his way of dealing with this was just to deflect and to make sure that question didn't get asked. And yeah, I mean, the Lance thing is funny, because I spent time, my first story for ESPN, the magazine, was on Lance when he was coming back from his cancer. And I had been in, this is a side, but I was into cycling a lot at the time, and I was getting ready to do my first 100-mile ride, and I asked Lance for advice, and the first thing he said was, you take 2 caffeine pills before the ride. At the 15-mile mark, you take another one. At 40, you take one. And I was just thinking, his first response wasn't like pedal through the pain. It was like to go right to the drugstore. And I often held that in my head, like, that was a bizarre response. But, you know, now we know that was the way those guys thought.
And by the way, I loved the Lance Armstrong documentary because it was so raw to me. I don't know if you felt the same way. I was on with Jason Fitz the next morning on the morning show. It was Memorial Day. And he goes, you know, I was sitting there with my wife and I was saying to her, you know, I just can't find anything likable about him. And he was sort of, Jason was complaining about that. And I'm like, well, that's because he's not likable.
Right. And that's what made that documentary spectacular was Lance has embraced that now. I mean, he is not trying to change your mind. I mean, he doesn't care. And he has, it's almost like he held all that in for so long. And now he's like, here I am, world. This is what I've been all along, and hate me as much as you want.
All right. So tell me, before you go, tell me what you're thinking about the baseball labor situation as the house burns and the two sides aren't really dealing with it.
Yeah, Buster, you've got the great analogy with the house burning and they're arguing over who's supposed to turn the faucet on the hose. I mean, that just seems to be the way it is. And I just feel like they're missing such an opportunity, and they're no matter what happens now, there's going to be a sour taste in this. I just feel like there's going to be, both sides are just going to be kind of at each other's throats, and it's going to affect the game one way or another down the line. And there's so much to gain here. And I just, you know, baseball has always had a hard time overcoming the people that run it, you know, and this gets back to the Maguire-Sosa thing where, this obsession with saving baseball. It's like they hop from crisis to crisis and then look for saviors, you know? And I think that's what they're doing now is just assuming that, you know, whatever, if the money's there, then the people will come back. And I don't know. I mean, the idea of imposing a 48 or 50 game season by Commissioner Fiat sounds like the worst idea. And it sounds like we're inching closer to that because nobody wants to really negotiate. They just want, and I personally put the onus on the owners because I think that they are really showing an unwillingness to compromise. And I just feel like the game is going to suffer in the long term. And I don't know. I mean, I would say it almost feels more likely that they don't play now.
And I tell you what, I agree with what you're saying. It feels like that they're taking the fans for granted. And when you look back, and I'm working on a piece that's going to run Monday after the documentary about all the things that went right for baseball after it came back from 94-95, a time of relative prosperity, not everybody out of work, not all the things we've seen since George Floyd was killed, all the lives lost to the coronavirus, but you had, you know, Cal Ripken. You had the return of the Yankees to preeminence, you know, a traditional power. You had all those new ballparks, right? You had, yep. You know, all these, yes, Camden Yards and Jacobs Field in Cleveland, and people wanted to go see those. I'm trying to envision what you know, who the saviors would be that they would rely on as they would come back, and I'm having a hard time with that.
Yeah, it's going to be much harder this time. I mean, we're not even getting into the whole public health issue of what happens when a team has 4 or 5 guys test positive. I mean, where do they go from there? I mean, I think that part of it's getting lost too, because the virus hasn't gone anywhere. It's just our perception of it seems to have changed. But I don't know. It's I don't envy them trying to figure out a way to restart a game. But if you look at basketball and you realize that basketball seems far riskier than baseball, there's a certain amount of distancing in baseball that they've proven in Korea that you can manage this if you've put in the work beforehand to make sure you know and you trace and all that. But yeah, I just don't know. I don't know where they go. I mean, once they start, what happens? And the players are rightfully, you know, hesitant on this. I agree with them that they need to be protected, and you know, they need to be protected financially too, if they're going to go out there and do this.
All right, Tim, thanks for doing this. Nice work.
Hey, thank you, Buster. Take care.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. First one up, Kyle Benning at Kyle_Benning writes in, if baseball doesn't happen in 2020, what team is hurt the most? The Cubs? Which teams will watch their championship windows close completely in 2020? The lost year if players and owners can't reach an agreement.
Kyle, the Mets. No question. Like, they loaded up with the resources the last couple of years in an effort to win in 2019, 2020. For 2020, they signed a couple of veteran starting pitchers to bolster their staff. They traded for Marcus Stroman last year, trying to bolster their rotation for this year. I was around them in spring training. They looked absolutely poised and ready to go. And it may be that that opportunity squandered. It's not only a, you know, tough situation for the players and their chance to win, but also ownership, because the team's been up for sale and you got to believe that the final sale price is going to be affected by what's going on.
Next up, we got Aaron at Aaron San Diego. Could you explain significance of Torkelson being drafted as a third baseman instead of a first baseman? Obviously, he'll be allowed to play in any position. I know this happened in the past. Brandon Inge being drafted as a catcher comes to mind.
Yeah, I think it's, first off, you know, teams like to keep their options open in terms of a player playing a more premium defensive position, because that only enhances their value. You know, we talked this week about Austin Martin, the Vanderbilt infielder who fell to fifth with the Blue Jays. You know, when we talked to Tim Corbin the other day, he mentioned him playing center field. He's played some third base. Kylie's talked about him being a second baseman. The Blue Jays announced when they took him that he was a shortstop. You know, they have Bo Bichette. They have a shortstop. But it's a case, and teams do this all the time. They'll absolutely try to maintain the appearance that a player can play a more premium position just to prop up their perceived value in the industry.
Senior Hendricks, last one for today at Senior Hendricks, writes in, what happens if a team folds due to financial issues caused by the coronavirus and the anticipated labor strike? Would they be bought out but stay in the same city, or is it entirely possible that they completely fold without being replaced?
At this point, I don't think that's a possibility. Now, if next year we get the labor strike does happen and the game is shut down, or if you get a lockout, you know, lockdown of some kind where baseball isn't played, then, yeah, maybe it would be a possibility. I don't think that they would contract. I know at the team level, there's been some discussion about that possibility. But remember what happened to the Expos when that franchise fell apart, you know, 6, 7, 8 years after the 94-95 strike. Major League Baseball took over ownership of that team and just basically held it in escrow, so to speak, until they could relocate the team and find the next owner for it.
Thank you for entertaining that last hypothetical there, Dr. Doom, with the bleakest of scenarios playing out. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Thanks for listening, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.
Yeah, my thanks today to Taylor and to Tim and to Todd. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on race is something we must fight every day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.